I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
These are some of the most famous words ever spoken.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the road to get to them was a long one. Kennedy Space Center Launch Complex 39. A lot of history has been made here. All but one of the Apollo missions started here between 1968 and 1972. Then came Skylab, and in 1981, the Space Shuttle, 135 flights. Now these launch pads are where SpaceX rockets start their flights to the International Space Station and beyond, and where NASA hopes the Space Launch System, a monster rocket, will take Americans back to the moon by 2024. Of course, the moon had always been an object of mystery and affection from mythology to popular culture. For singers, there's been a certain romantic appeal.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars.
Maybe not so romantic for TV's Honeymooners in the 1950s.
I am going!
The only place you're going is to the moon!
It was a popular destination for the movies, like H.G. Wells' First Men on the Moon.
Claim for Her Majesty Queen Victoria in the year of our Lord 1899. Well, how are we going to explain this?
And 2001, A Space Odyssey.
What's more, the evidence seems pretty conclusive that it hasn't been covered up by natural erosion or other forces. It seems to have been deliberately buried.
But those were movies. In July 1969, humans were going to the moon for real. The end of a space race that began with the Soviet Union's early successes. The USSR orbited the first satellite, Sputnik, in 1957, and on April 12, 1961, the first human, Yuri Gagarin. American Alan Shepard took a 15-minute suborbital space flight in May, and less than 3 weeks after that,
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
President John F. Kennedy's challenge to the nation in an address to Congress on May 25, 1961. NASA moved from Mercury to Gemini and then Apollo. And as the U.S. was winning the space race in the summer of 1969, there was so much else happening right here on Earth.
This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius.
I, Richard Bilhouse Nixon, do solemnly swear
that you will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
It's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam.
It was just like any ordinary Vietnamese village. Usually the ones that we go to are women, children, old men. What was happening is the people were being shot by the members of my company, being rounded up into groups, and all the civilians, to my knowledge, there were killed.
We also recommend if you're going to take some acid, don't take the blue ones, and if you're going to take some, take half a tab first to test it, you know?
A double blowout, it's all over! They're mobbing Gary Gentry, the Mets. The fans are pouring out on the field. There's an explosion of paper pouring down on the field as the Mets run to the dugout. The Mets have done it.
Richard Nixon, Vietnam, Woodstock, the amazing Mets, and so much more made 1969 an amazing year. But Apollo 11 was the biggest story of them all. During this next hour, you'll hear about and from people who made it happen, and hopefully a whole lot that you've never heard before. But as with any space story, it all starts with launch. You know, it's pretty dangerous to be out here at the launch pad when that happens. So we're going west a few miles to the Kennedy Space Center's Launch Control Center firing room. It's a lot cooler in here. On Wednesday, July 16th, 1969, it was a lot busier. NASA's Jack King started heading here from his house in Cocoa Beach at 1 a.m. as he drove up A1A and then across the Banana River and then took a right to Kennedy Space Center, what he saw astounded him.
There's just a line of cars in parallel, recreation vehicles, tents. I couldn't even see the river because of all the cars there that were already lined up to get their favorite location.
Reporter Vic Ratner was here for New York radio station WMCA.
America lined the waterways, the roadways, every place within 50 miles where somebody could see a launch. There was a trailer, there was an RV, there was a camper tent. There were people who had stayed not just overnight, but days and even weeks to watch that mission go off.
Westinghouse Broadcasting correspondent Jim Slade had been anticipating the moment for years.
After a decade inching forward, here it was. We were on our way.
NASA engineer Bob Seek was already working on Apollo 12, so he had the day off.
We were advised to stay off the center, don't add to the gridlock of traffic that was in the area.
He was across the Indian River, along US 1 in Titusville.
Traffic was just essentially stopped. People had just parked their cars on the highway, were sitting on the roof or on the hood or whatever.
11-year-old Terry Rowan was there too with her Girl Scout troop selling food.
We ran out of donuts, not once, but twice, but three times. And the leaders had to go to the local donut shop and get supplies.
About 100 miles away in Sebring, Florida, 15-year-old Rick Frischman was just waking up at summer camp.
And 1 week before the Apollo 11 went up, we actually went to Kennedy Space Center and saw the rocket.
But back to Jack King, whose launch day ritual included a stop on the way here to the firing room.
I would pull off the side of the road and just leave the car running, get out, and just stand there and admire this majestic rocket across the river that was just bathed in floodlights.
Then it was on to the very place where I'm sitting. If his voice sounds familiar, it should.
This is Apollo Saturn Launch Control. We've just passed the 56-minute mark in our countdown. We're still proceeding in an excellent manner at this time.
King had already called the Gemini launches in 1965 and 66. NASA called it Gemini. And the first four manned Apollo flights.
Although everything seemed to be the same, this was different. This was different. This was certainly a very, very special time.
Hundreds of millions of people followed the countdown on radio and TV, listening to their favorite reporters or anchors, and especially to Jack King.
As I approached the final seconds of the countdown, I had all these voices coming in my ear. And then all of a sudden another voice came in. It was mine. It said, "My God, we're going. We're going to the moon."
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 0, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
For CBS News radio listeners, it was King and Reed Collins.
We're beginning to feel the first thunderous roar. I can see her rising now as she's going up straight into the roll program, which she should be completing. We should expect to hear from the astronauts as this spit of land is beginning to shake with the power of it.
We could see the flame, see the rocket go up.
What it sounded like on radio was hearing me for about 3 seconds before I was drowned out by the roar from the Saturn V engine.
Once you get liftoff, the windows start to rattle and that sound hits you.
The ground shook. Your body shook. You could feel it deep in your gut.
We were able to see the first stage separate way up in the sky. It was amazing.
You can hear a Saturn V from miles away. Well, you couldn't hear it over there for the roar of the people and the horns blaring and the shouting.
I'm proud, as everybody else who was involved, to have been involved. It was a fantastic moment.
The Apollo 11 countdown made Jack King's voice one of the most heard voices in the history of recorded sound. It's been used in thousands of TV shows, movies, commercials. But as a NASA employee, he never made a dime from it. Jack died in 2015, 6 years after he shared his launch day experiences with us. You know, hundreds of thousands of people made the Apollo program happen. And we'll talk about some of those unsung heroes like Abe Silverstein, NASA's director of spaceflight programs in the early 60s. His nephew Norm Winsky remembers that NASA's administrator asked him what the U.S. could do to beat the Soviet Union.
And Abe turned to James Webb and said, well, we could go to the moon. And Webb says, well, how long?
after doing some calculations for about a minute, Abe turns it turns and says, oh, well, we could do that by the end of the decade.
Winsky says his uncle also came up with a name for the moon program.
Abe had been reading at that time a book on Greek mythology and said, how about Apollo? And it stuck.
My own unsung heroes are the men and women who've just finished restoring the Apollo mission control room right down to the last detail.
Maps, pens, papers, the ashtrays, the large ashtrays. You know, they needed the big ashtrays because they smoke so much.
Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Back to Houston. Houston. Houston.
We're at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. In 1969, it was called the Manned Spacecraft Center. And if there was a flight in progress, I wouldn't have been allowed anywhere near where I am right now, the flight director's seat in the newly restored Apollo Mission Control Room. Gene Kranz was right here for what would hopefully be Apollo 11's moon landing, July 20th, 1969.
This was a team that was composed of individuals, strong individuals, young individuals from all the states in the Union, who came together and formed a chemistry and an organization. And this chemistry allowed us to become greater than the sum of our parts.
Kranz's team had run the Apollo 10 dress rehearsal for the lunar landing just 2 months earlier. Charlie Duke was an astronaut with a moon landing in his future, but during Apollo 11, he was the CAPCOM, the capsule communicator, the crew's link to mission control during the flight.
It was decided that our whole team would just move over into Apollo 11 since we had all the experience.
Gene Kranz had some words for his team before Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin started their trip down to the lunar surface.
Our training was tough, but we are ready. And then it concluded with two sentences that stuck in all my controllers' minds. I will stand behind every decision you will make. We came into this room as a team, and we will leave as a team.
The final miles to the moon were anything but smooth.
We would battle.
First, we had communication problems. We had to reorient the spacecraft to get better data and communication, voice communications.
Got us locked up there, Telcom.
Okay, it's just real weak flight.
Okay, how you look? All your systems go?
That's a firm flight.
And then we started having computer overloads, and the first computer problem we had.
1202 alarm.
When I saw that, I said, well, we're dead in the water. We can't make it.
But it had come up during the last simulation 2 weeks earlier, something guidance officer Steve Bales recalled.
We're going that flight.
We're going that alarm?
If it doesn't reoccur, we'll be go.
The computer guys knew the situation, of course, and Steve Bales and Jack Garman, who was in the back room, they almost instantly came up your go flight.
Time was running out, and so was fuel on the Eagle lunar lander. Neil Armstrong faced another problem. He told CBS 60 Minutes about it in 2003.
Our autopilot was taking us into a very large crater, about the size of a big football stadium, with steep slopes on the crater covered with very large rocks about the size of automobiles. That was not the kind of place I wanted to try to make the first landing.
On TV, CBS's Walter Cronkite nervously watched the landing clock tick down to zero with no landing.
We suddenly realized that he'd made a detour, and we didn't know how long that detour was going to be. Yes, I was very much concerned. I think all of us who were following the flight that closely were scared to death. If he wasn't, we were.
I ended up calling 30 seconds, I remember, which is 30 seconds before an abort call. And then they landed, like, according to my watch, 13 seconds later.
It was 16 seconds of fuel left.
Buzz Aldrin, who says he was never worried.
That was Neil's job.
Contact light?
Contact light.
CBS Radio's Reed Collins.
Okay, engine stopped.
Stop the engine.
Had a descent. Hose control, both auto descent, engine command override off. Engine arm off. 413 is in.
They're on the moon.
On CBS television.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Oh, boy. What?
Turned out I didn't have anything to say at all, except, whoa, oh, boy, oh, boy. Perfectly speechless.
Astronaut Bruce McCandless was in mission control before his CAPCOM shift, watching and listening.
The control room did erupt in a pandemonium of cheers and waving little flags and things of that sort. And the flight director did have to say, okay, folks.
Basically, they were stomping their feet right on down the line, and I had to keep my team cool. I got mad. I said, okay, settle down. Okay, we got the stay-no-stay decision in 2 minutes.
Decades later, Buzz Aldrin remembered the time after touchdown as calm.
Things were quiet, and we gazed out the window, and it was just a magnificent view.
But there was no time for Gene Kranz and his flight controllers to enjoy the glory. There were decisions to make.
We had to maintain cool, calm, steely-eyed missile men to make sure it was safe to remain on the surface.
And then some time to exhale. As for Charlie Duke, he'd land on the moon on Apollo 16. He's probably most remembered for what happened on this day, and he's okay with that.
To have that honor of being there in part of the team that landed the first human beings, helped land the first human beings on the moon, was a great thrill.
The flight plan had Armstrong and Aldrin taking a two-hour nap before their moonwalk. So Bruce McCandless went home for dinner before starting his CAPCOM shift.
And I got home to find my wife running down the driveway telling me, they can't sleep, go back. So, of course, I turned around and went back, and I saw the moon rising directly above the roadway. And for the life of me, I couldn't bring myself to believe that since the moon didn't look any different, that we really had people on it.
Not only that, but it was all going to be seen live on TV if a small Westinghouse black and white camera did its job.
You know, perhaps we're naive. I think most of us thought it was going to work.
Mark Kramer was a CBS News researcher and a future space coverage producer. He remembers the network's backup plans, which included men in spacesuits simulating the moonwalk in a darkened airplane hangar.
And it sat on a lunar surface of sorts, which we created by bringing in tons and tons of slag from an iron ore mine. And the slag was pushed around and made to look like a lunar surface with craters and so on.
As for Bruce McCandless, he skipped his dinner. He was quickly back at his post, talking with Armstrong and Aldrin on the moon, and Michael Collins orbiting overhead in Columbia.
I really got back into the swing of things and realized that we were doing it for real this time.
His job, to help keep the crew on track and stay out of their way.
And what any one of those three have to say, from a historical or even a scientific or engineering perspective, far outweighs most of what we could have to say.
Although some of McCandless's words are among the most heard in history, as Neil Armstrong headed out.
And we're getting a picture on the TV. Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
One of the biggest pre-flight questions was about to be answered. What would Armstrong say when he took that first step? In 2003, he told 60 Minutes he spent some time thinking about it.
Well, I thought, well, when I step off, it's just going to be a little step. It's going to be a step from there down to there. But then I thought about all those 400,000 people that had given me the opportunity to make that step, and thought it's going to be a big something for all those folks, and indeed a lot of others that even weren't even involved in the project. So it was a kind of a simple correlation of thoughts.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. That's the surface is fine and powdery. I can kick it up loosely with my toe.
It's a brilliant surface in that sunlight. The horizon seems quite close to you because the curvature is so much more pronounced than here on Earth. It's an interesting place to be. I recommend it.
Isn't that something? Magnificent sight out here. Magnificent desolation.
As Buzz Aldrin stepped on the moon, there was another drama going on in mission control involving a phone call.
President Nixon is in the Oval Office and he would like to speak to the Apollo 11 crew now.
Bruce McCandless told us about it in 2014, 3 years before he died.
We discussed amongst ourselves a bit and wound up stiff-arming, if you will,
the president for about 45 minutes while we got the really essential items out of the way.
Like getting those precious moon rocks and soil samples. Richard Nixon did speak to Armstrong and Aldrin.
For every American, this has to be the proudest day of our lives.
Mike Collins, overhead in the Columbia Command Module, got to hear what was going on.
I guess you're about the only person around that doesn't have TV coverage of the scene.
That's all right, I don't mind a bit.
Recently, Collins told us he hadn't changed his mind about that.
Did I have the best seat on Apollo 11? No, but I was absolutely thrilled to have the seat that I did have. It was a culmination of John F. Kennedy's mandate, and I was proud to be a part of that.
He says the only thing he worried about was that an engine failure might strand his crewmates on the moon.
That engine had to work perfectly. If it would fail to start for some reason, that was the end of them. They were dead. I'm going home by myself. Those were the things that worried me.
Of course, that didn't happen, and Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins did make it back to Earth together. The largest TV audience in history at the time watched the Apollo 11 moonwalk in private homes and in public places like New York's Kennedy Airport. The CBS had a huge screen. Among those watching there, a 12-year-old boy who hoped that space reporting might be in his future. Who knew? And by the way, there were millions of other kids watching that night, including the children of the Apollo 11 crew. So what's it like when your father is going to the moon? Rick Armstrong was 12 and says the talk with his dad went pretty much as moviegoers saw in the film First Man.
Do you think you're coming back?
We have a real confidence in the mission, and there are some risks, but we have every intention of coming back.
But you might not.
That's right.
Rick says he was never worried about the danger.
What I thought was they could fix whatever problems came up. When you're a kid, you just think your dad can do that, right? So anything that happens, your dad can do. And that I thought that not just because of what he could do, but what everybody on the team, what the mission control guys could do, the whole team of people, you just felt like whatever came up, they could handle it.
Buzz Aldrin's son, Andy, was 11.
You know, I don't remember him sitting us down and having a serious conversation. I remember being aware of all of the issues, but it was more like I was aware because we were just around talking all the time.
And Michael Collins' daughter, Ann Starr, was 8 years old.
I remember he had some of the dehydrated food, and he let us sample that. It was not tasty, let's just put it that way. But I credit my mother quite a lot, too, because she had to be strong in front of the kids during the time where she probably was secretly very nervous about his safety.
While you and I might think our dads flying in space would be extraordinary, it's a whole lot different when you grow up around it.
It was normal. So you couldn't swing a dead cat at my middle school without hitting an astronaut's kid.
Every single neighbor was either an astronaut or an engineer or in some capacity with NASA. So to us, space flight had become fairly routine.
That's just how it was. That's just the part of the deal. Didn't compare it to a different life. You just look at it in your own terms.
During the flight, the astronauts' homes in Houston were surrounded by reporters and photographers trying to watch their families' every move, while the astronaut mothers tried to protect their kids from the media glare. Andy Aldrin says that didn't always work.
Pretty much I busted out. I did. I don't think my mom was that delighted about it. There's one picture of my mother and me walking out of church. And if you look at this picture, it's clear I did something. That I'm in big trouble.
Rick Armstrong says he was resourceful, too.
If you wanted to go somewhere, yeah, you had to be a little trickier. Fortunately, we had a woods behind our house, and so, you know, we had ways to get out if we wanted to go. It just took a little longer.
But in the Collins house, Ann Starr says she wasn't quite as lucky.
We were not allowed to go outside of our home without an adult supervisor.
That must have been crazy.
It was bizarre. It was bizarre, but it was for a limited period.
There was no live TV of the landing, a disappointment to Andy Aldrin.
I mean, I can watch the Dallas Cowboys on TV. Why can't I see this?
But the moonwalk, of course, was televised, and the 11-year-old Andy had just one thing on his mind.
Dad's bouncing around on the moon. There's a cable that's going from the lunar module out to some instrument. And I'm looking at the cable, I'm looking at Dad kind of bouncing around the moon, and you know, he's like skidding every time he hits. And I'm convinced he's going to trip over this cable. He's going to fall on his back, embarrass the heck out of me in front of, I mean, forget about the 300 million people that are watching. I'm worried about the 300 kids at my school.
That, of course, didn't happen. Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Mike Collins did return safely to Earth, a planet that suddenly had been changed by mankind's first steps on another world. The crew's family's lives changed, too. Rick Armstrong says his dad wasn't necessarily as recognizable as, say, Muhammad Ali, but still.
You'd be out to dinner, and somebody across the room would be kind of doing one of these, looking at him like, I think, I'm not sure who that is, but I know him from somewhere. And eventually someone would recognize him and come over and say, oh, could I have your autograph? And then as soon as that happened, it was like open the floodgates.
For Andy Aldrin, the aftermath wasn't a big deal.
I'm sure other kids thought a lot about it more than I did. Like, I was kind of oblivious, I think.
But life quickly became hard for his father.
The difficulties that he had a huge effect on the family. And the divorce had a huge effect on the family. And alcoholism had a huge effect on the family. I mean, those were big deals. Yeah.
Because no one in the astronaut corps or in the NASA community spoke openly about those things. At least not until Buzz Aldrin retired from NASA and wrote about all of that in his first memoir, Return to Earth, 4 years later. As for the Collins family, Anne Starr remembers a sense of calm when her dad came back.
He's always been somebody that is very hands-on as a parent. Mm-hmm. So when he came home, I think he felt a sense of relief. Hey, now I can play with the kids and that type of thing.
To Starr, her father is just dad and grandpa.
It's kind of amusing at times because I have five children, and so when they study this aspect of American history, you know, they've known Mikey. Hope that's okay that we use his family name. But, you know, forever as a fun, loving, he's a very funny, great, easygoing guy. So mm-hmm. they know him as Grandpa Mike. Mm-hmm. They'll come home from school like, wow, I didn't even, they know everything, but they didn't understand that it was interesting in history because they've grown up with it personally. Mm-hmm.
Andy Aldrin says the families were friendly back in the day.
I kind of joke a little bit. I think the kids get along a lot better than the astronauts did.
But they weren't close as kids. As the anniversaries come and go, Ann Starr says the Apollo children have become closer.
The wives of the astronauts had a group that got together every year called Keep in Touch. And so we have an informal thing called Keep in Touch Junior.
Starr actively promotes space and STEM education. Andy Aldrin, he's a professor at Florida Institute of Technology and runs its programs for would-be space entrepreneurs as well as the Aldrin Space Institute. Rick Armstrong lives in Ohio. He owns a software development and consulting company. He's a trustee for the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation. He's also a musician who's playing gigs to help celebrate the Apollo 11 anniversary. Our next unsung hero is somebody you heard about earlier, Flight Controller and Guidance Officer Steve Bales, who recognized the program alarms that came up during the landing phase of Apollo 11. CBS News space consultant Bill Harwood says during a simulation just 15 days earlier,
they didn't understand the alarms. They didn't know what it meant with the computer. They thought the only thing to do would be to abort, which raises the question, if they hadn't done that simulation and they're attempting to land on the moon and these alarms came up, they might well have called it off. So it was a remarkable turn of events that they simulated it and that these very young flight controllers digested that. They dissected it, totally understood it. And when Apollo 11 was doing it for real, it allowed 26-year-old Steve Bales to say, we're go on that alarm flight.
Author and historian Andrew Chaikin's unsung hero, George Lowe, who took over spacecraft design after the launch pad fire that killed the first Apollo crew in 1967.
He was really the consummate engineer, and he understood that the fire was a wake-up call to NASA, that they had to step up to a new level of rigor if they wanted to get to the moon by the end of the decade. Lowe brought a quiet, penetrating intelligence to the job and led Apollo out of the ashes of the fire and on to the successful landing on the moon by Apollo 11.
The Eagle has landed. Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
For the last 50 years, technology has contributed to the teaching of one of science's greatest achievements.
When did we go for the first time to the moon?
In classrooms across the country, you'll find teachers like Peter Giles giving lessons on the first lunar landing.
First time we went there was with Apollo. Apollo 11. You might have heard that, Apollo 11, right? Let me just tell you about what that mission
Giles like, teaches okay? science at this New York's Center for Aerospace and Applied Mathematics. On the day we visited, these students were learning about how long it took to get to the moon.
How long did it take to get to the moon? Yes. 24 hours. One day.
A week.
A month.
A year.
What? 3 days.
Three days
to get to the moon.
And they were learning about the crew that made history.
Let me know, who was one of the first astronauts to go to the moon? You probably know that one, yeah.
Neil Armstrong.
Anyone have a second one?
No.
Yeah.
Look at me, I have all the credit.
Buzz Aldrin. There's a third astronaut
Michael
up there.
Michael Collins.
We asked students about what they learned and whether being an astronaut might be in their future.
Think you're going to want to be an astronaut one day?
Yes, I am.
Well, I'll be in the space station for like 5 years and then like move on.
No.
No, why not?
Because I don't want to go to space. It's too scary and I don't want to risk my life, so no.
Do you remember what year we landed on the moon for the first time?
1969?
1967?
1969.
1902? 1972.
50 years after the historic event, students are learning about the moon landing in new ways. Michael McDonald is the principal at Brooklyn's Midwood High School.
Every classroom pretty much has a television smart board with access to the internet, access to computer technology. And I think one of the interesting things we used to bring out about the moon landings is that we have the kids take their cell phone out of their pocket, that your cell phone is maybe 100 times more powerful than the computer that was built to bring the to go to the moon. And the jump in technology that occurred really is because of the moon landing.
But McDonald says advanced technology isn't always the best way to teach or learn.
One of the problems we have in earth science is teaching that the lunar landings actually occurred in the past several years because of the wonderful internet. A lot of students come in to us having seen documentaries that show that the lunar landings were actually staged someplace. You know, kids have been exposed to this, and it's pretty powerful because they'll show them videos from certain directions and know the shadow's in the wrong place or the flag can't stand like that.
Some believe we're already visiting other planets. Catherine Brown is director of New York's Center for Aerospace and Applied Mathematics.
Very few kids doubt that we went to the moon. That's actually not our issue. Our issue is most kids think that the space shuttle went to the moon, and most kids think that we're going to Mars on a regular basis. We work on that misconception and letting them know that we haven't been to the moon since 1972 and no human being has ever stepped foot on another planet.
Space exploration has come a long way in 50 years, and who's to say we don't go even further in the next 50?
We call our current elementary school students Martians of tomorrow. And we tell them the reason they are the Martians of tomorrow is because they are of the age of the human who will first walk on Mars.
And we're going to that big apartment building in the sky. What is it?
The solar system.
The ISS, the International Space Station.
Of course, the technology those future Martians will use will probably be light years better than what we're using today. The same way that today's technology is far more advanced than what Apollo used. NASA often makes the case that today's microelectronics and satellite technology may never have happened, or at least not as quickly, without the space program. As for now versus then, here's CBS News technology expert Larry Magid.
It's always amazed me how the engineers who designed the computing systems used on the Apollo 11 were so efficient in how they took advantage of the hardware that was available at the time. The guidance computer had about 2K of memory, which is a tiny fraction of what we have in today's computers, or even smartphones or smart watches. What's impressive is how efficient the software was to do the types of calculations it had to do, given the state of hardware at the time.
Keep in mind that computers back then took up entire rooms, in some cases entire buildings. You couldn't send those to the moon, or anywhere else in space for that matter. Too big, too expensive. NASA and its contractors had to invent more compact devices for the command and lunar modules. They were very elementary, but they did the job. And of course, some say technology did the job all too well. I'm talking about the people who say that NASA faked the whole thing. For example, Bart Sibrel, who appeared on a Fox News program in 2001.
NASA orchestrated the hoax in a very unique way, through television. They had one picture, which they completely controlled, black and white, brainy that convinced everybody we were on the moon.
Next year, he had a notorious confrontation with Buzz Aldrin.
You're the one who said you walked on the moon when you didn't. Calling the kettle black, if I ever thought of it. Saying
Will
I misrepresented
get it
myself.
Away from me?
You're a coward and a liar and a thief.
That didn't end well. So we asked Apollo Flight Director Gene Kranz what he tells anyone who says the whole thing was faked.
You sit down and say, do you think we could have fooled the Russians? Do you think we could have fooled all the national laboratories that we sent these rocks to? Do you think we could have fooled them? The fact is, we're Americans. You think we could have fooled the media? Fact is, everything we did was wide open. And I think they had the opportunity to see it, make their own judgment.
Gene Kranz worked closely with our next unsung hero, Bill Tindall, one of Apollo's key planners. Nancy Atkinson writes about Tindall in her book, 8 Years to the Moon.
He was given the job of coordinating the mind-boggling concept of rendezvous, which is how two spacecraft meet up in space, and later was responsible for the development of the Apollo guidance and navigation computer software. But the way Tindall could instinctively unravel a wide variety of issues made it seem like spaceflight was part of his soul.
Just how important was Bill Tindall? Well, Gene Kranz asked him to sit with him at the flight director's console on landing day, saying this was his moment. 50 years later, why does Apollo 11 matter? We spoke to many people who looked not at the moon, but to the Earth. Flight Director Gene Kranz.
What America can dare, America can do. I think you have to clearly set a set of objectives, and you have to have the energy within the population, within our government, within our industry to follow that direction and make things happen.
Current NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine wasn't even born when Apollo 11 flew, but he studied his history. He says the mission's success marked the beginning of the end for the Cold War.
That was a seminal moment in a balance of power shift from one part of the world to another part of the world that forever changed history.
The U.S. and Russia have been in space together for more than two decades. So what happens when people open the history books and say 500 years? What will the future historians write about the 20th century? CBS News space consultant Bill Harwood.
They might forget the details of World War II, as hard as that might be to believe, or World War I, certainly the Depression. But stepping off the planet, moving out into the solar system for the first time, how do you top that? That is the triumph of Apollo.
But humans haven't left Earth orbit since 1972. George Washington University space historian John Logsdon had high hopes when he attended the Apollo 11 launch.
One of the things I did there was put my name on the list with Pan Am Airlines for a flight to the moon. Well, that hasn't happened in these 50 years.
The Trump administration wants Americans back there by 2024. Money is expected to be the biggest obstacle. Still, much has changed in the last 50 years. More countries and more people have access to space through NASA, through the Russians, and the private space industry. That's Andy Aldrin's department.
I ran into a group of middle school kids. These kids were literally building a spacecraft. Middle school kids, right? These kids are like 10, 12 years old. I mean, it was just amazing.
Apollo 11's Michael Collins had a lot of time to look at the moon while his crewmates landed and walked there. He says he spent much of that time looking at the Earth instead.
It projects a quality that I found very surprising. It projects a feeling of fragility. And I'd like to keep people remembering that it is fragile.
Collins' daughter, Ann Starr, says perhaps Apollo's greatest legacy is that it brought people together.
My father always notes that wherever they were, people were clapping and saying, we did it, as in humanity.
When we first started work on this program, my question was, what more can possibly be said about Apollo 11? I guess we've all found out together, haven't we? Our thanks go to the many people who you heard during this program and some you didn't hear. People like Ashley Armstrong, our associate producer, researcher, contributing interviewer, and contributing writer. Lisa Meyer Steinhaus conducted some of our interviews, and her editorial experience and contributions were invaluable. Jamie Benson is our creative services producer. Special thanks to Miles Doran at CBS News Atlanta and to NASA, Kennedy Space Center, and Johnson Space Center. One Giant Leap Revisited was produced, written, and edited by Peter King. Our executive producer is Jonathan Clark. Craig Swagler is the senior vice president of CBS News Radio. And Susan Zirinsky is the president of CBS News. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at CBS News Radio. Who knows what the next 50 years in space will bring? We don't know, of course, but I can promise you that CBS News will be here to cover it from the moon to Mars and beyond, if and when all that happens. Thanks for listening. I'm Peter King, CBS News.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.